Welcome to the 2011 Formula One Teams Association Fans Forum podcast, brought to you by Autosport and USP Content. Part 2, The Engineers, featuring Paddy Lowe, Technical Director of Vodafone McLaren Mercedes, James Allison, Technical Director of Lotus Renault Grand Prix, and Paul Monaghan, Head of Car Engineering at Red Bull Racing. Let's join Photo Fans Forum host, James Allen.
So part 2 of the Photo Fans Forum here at the McLaren Technology Centre in Woking is the guys who really know what's going on in Formula One. And that is the senior engineers. And we've got three of the most senior and most respected engineers in the world of Formula One to talk to you today. So let's start out by welcoming the technical director of this team, Vodafone McLaren Mercedes. Please welcome Paddy Lowe. The technical director of Lotus Renault GP, James Allison. And the guy who's winning everything at the moment, Paul Monaghan, Head of Race Engineering from Red Bull Racing. Now, we already know that Ben Murphy isn't here because he just missed out on a prize, and he had the first question, so he's missed out on that as well. Bad day for Ben Murphy. Let's get a view from, sorry, question from Paul Taylor. Is he here, Paul Taylor? Regarding the DRS and KERS, etc. Paul, take it away.
Hi guys. It's with the introduction of tyre degradation, DRS and KERS, there seems to be an element of the loss of driver skill in overtaking moves. How can we get that driver skill back into the sport?
Thank you very much for your question. Take it away, Paddy.
Overtaking is a very difficult topic, and as you know, it's one that's been debated over 10, 15 years that I've been aware. People often look back to some rosy picture of the old days when there were great overtakes, and why aren't there any more? My view is you do need overtaking. You need it at every circuit, not just some circuits. But you need it to be not trivial. It needs to be a great moment. So I was liken that to needing something like you have in football, rather than what you may have in basketball. I think what we've done this year, the combination of those three elements you mentioned, has dramatically improved the number of overtaking manoeuvres. So I suggest your question is, are there now too many and are they too easy? I feel not really. Perhaps a little bit here and there we've seen overtaking to be perhaps easier than you might have liked, but it's still never easy. We still see plenty of places where overtakes have failed, and that can be just as interesting as a successful overtake. So I think the balance is better. I think we can, with the DRS, tune it to be even better. One of the things, you know, bearing in mind DRS was a photo initiative which we designed last year, and my colleagues on the panel here were part of the group defining those rules. We were very clear that we wanted the FIA to have some knobs that they could turn in order to tune the extent to which DRS affected overtaking. So those specific knobs are the length of the and position of the straights where you can use it. And the other one that could be tuned is the gap, the 1 second interval which triggers it. And we've left that for the FIA to select on a race-by-race basis in order to make overtaking balanced between extreme difficulty and extreme ease at the right level. And I have to say, you know, we're only 8 races in, they're still learning what's the best positioning for that, and that will of course vary from circuit to circuit. So I think it can only improve if at the moment here and there it's been a little bit too easy.
James, what's your view?
Well, I think I'd probably reject the premise to some extent. I don't think that driver skill is in any way reduced by this year's rules. There is more overtaking, certainly, and that's, you know, that was the intention of a lot of what we've done for the sport in the rules this year. But in no way does that diminish the driver's skill. It just means there is more overtaking. And as Paddy has said, at the odd track this year, perhaps there has been a little bit too much. But I think if you look at the season as a whole, the races we've had this year, we've had several absolute crackers. At most tracks, the overtaking remains extremely challenging. And I think while there is an element of the DRS in particular that offends the purist, which I completely understand, I think that the overall balance is one of a sport that is more thrilling to watch. If I use my wife or my mum as a yardstick, as opposed to someone who's really into the sport, I've seen my wife in particular willing to sit through a whole race because there's excitement from the start to the finish. And I think all of us know that that hasn't always been the case in the past. Some tracks we go to with a heavy heart in the past because we knew that there was going to be an extraordinarily dull affair from start to finish. And we haven't had that this year, and I think that that's a good thing.
She'll be on Sector Times next. You want to watch her? Yeah. But Ross's wife. Paul, what's your view on this?
I don't think we've diminished driver skill at all. A lot of the things you've spoken of with KERS and so on are complementary to their skills, and they choose to exploit them. And it's up to the teams to provide a car to the drivers that can exploit all of these things. In establishing DRS, we sought to give a trailing car a small performance advantage, and as Paddy and James have alluded to, you don't make the overtaking a formality, you still present a reasonable challenge. And as James alluded to, we will change or tune the DRS to be exactly that. And I think the evidence so far is that we haven't had dull races with overtaking being a formality. It's I'd say one of the more exciting seasons to watch. I can't say my wife watches the split times, fortunately. Goodness me, I'd be in trouble if she did sometimes. And I wouldn't have said we've diminished them at all. They're just complementary, and the drivers that exploit it are still the good ones.
Just very quickly, Paddy, I know you've got a point you want to make, but could you also just very briefly explain the mechanism by which you actually are involved in making the rules? Because I think quite a lot of fans perhaps don't realise it's not the FIA necessarily who just tell you what to do. You actually had a hand in this. In this.
So we have a number of photo groups who look at the rules. We're all on the technical regulations working group, which looks clearly at the technical regs. So we will discuss generally a year or so ahead of time initiatives that we might like to take, either to control cost, you know, if we're doing something that we're all doing the same thing, spending a lot of money and it's all a bit needless, we may agree to constrain that. Or initiatives such as the DRS, where we see an opportunity to make the sport more entertaining, more fulfilling for the spectators. So we sit, we vote, there is a majority system. Anything we agree will get put to the team principals within FOTA. If they agree to it, then it will go to the formal FIA bodies, which are the TWG, Technical Working Group. Again, there is a voting process there. If it's too near the coming season, it requires unanimity to change something. If there's enough notice period, which is about 6 months, we can change it with majority. So the DRS, for instance, was all developed in the TRWG in a very friendly manner, I must say, then went to the TWG for the texts to be very carefully scrutinised and developed over several months so that we would have exactly what we intended. And then it goes to a number of other bodies that work up the chain, ultimately ending at the World Motorsport Council, who will approve that text. So that's how a technical regulation is made.
Fair enough. Let's have some points. Sorry,
James, I wonder if we could ask the audience on the DRS.
I was just about to.
A couple of things.
Yep. Go on, you set the agenda then.
Firstly, do you think everybody understands it?
Okay, first of all, does everyone understand it? Okay.
And secondly, do we think it's artificial and bad for the sport?
Hands up, well up, so we can see them clearly. If you think it's artificial and bad for the sport, that's about a quarter to a third, I would say.
Okay. Those are two separate questions. Artificial is one, bad is another. I'd be interested to know the bad part.
How many think would go so far as to say it was a bad thing for Formula One to have the DRS? Just a couple of four hands, yeah. Okay. Of the people who've got their hands up then, can we get a microphone to the gentleman at the back and you can tell us why you think that?
The most straight-talking driver of the current drivers is Mark Webber. And when he comes out and says quite plainly, he doesn't get any enjoyment from it. It's not what I like to see in Formula One. I've been supporting Formula One since 1970. And it's just ridiculous seeing the way some of these drivers are just whizzing past others. It's just not how I think F1 should be.
Okay, let's take some other points of view from around the room. Yep, gentleman with his hand up there, please.
In reply to that one there, is DRS no different than the push-to-pass that you'd get in IndyCar or anything else previous to that? Does that make the other series any more artificial?
That needs a response from an engineer. Paul, perhaps?
Without having great knowledge of what an IndyCar push-to-pass button does, if it creates a performance difference between the cars, it allows you more revs, more turbo boost or something like that, then it's pretty similar effect, really, isn't it? You improve the performance of the following car to help it make a challenge on the lead car. Not a formality, you hope.
Gentleman here.
I'm sort of halfway. I don't like it. I think it's artificial, but it's better than the following leader we used to have, so I think we're stuck with it.
Just out of interest, how many people actually are really happy with the racing that we've had this year, found it exciting and have found that more of their friends who were sceptical? Yeah, exactly.
So. Yeah, if I could just answer the Mark Webber point, much as I would love Mark to enjoy his DRS overtakes, we don't do the sport to make Mark happy.
He's going to be gutted about that, mate. He's going to be gutted. Fair enough. One more quick point of view. Gentleman at the back there. Stand up, please. That's it. Last view on the DRS. Yeah.
Hi, guys. The problem, I think, with the DRS is how inconsistent it's been. If we look at Turkey, all the moves were done, by and large, before the braking zone, and Montreal as well. Like, people would just go around the outside of Michael, and they've done the move before. Whereas at other tracks, it's worked perfectly, hasn't it? I mean, it's still been an overtaking move on the brakes. Do we need to look at next year for changing it track to track, like maybe the gap between the cars or something like that?
Good question. Paddy?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I meant by tuning. And I think second year round at each circuit, I hope the FIA will be taking account of exactly those sort of things. I think there we had an example. I think that the zone was too long, perhaps. I still don't fully understand the reason for the second zone. And I think the FIA are acknowledging that as well now.
Do you think you might lose that second zone now?
Well, there may be some tracks at which it's the right thing, but it seemed in Canada the first zone was very much longer. So if you were going to make an overtake stick, generally you were going to do it there. And then that meant that the second zone was purely a means of opening the gap further for the guy that had already got past.
Fair enough. Okay.
I would say, however, that the FIA have done a pretty good job at trimming it so far. It's their first time round with all the circuits this year. They've only got the distance variable as the thing that they play with, and I think they by and large have set it pretty well.
Yeah. So there's a good kind of spirit of cooperation between you and them, clearly,
yeah,
on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So is Brendan Goodjohn here? Brendan Goodjohn has a question about the hot blown diffusers. It's not a change of rules, I've been told. It's a change of interpretations. Very important to know the distinction.
Alia, obviously you probably all spent many hours sat in the wind tunnels and on the simulators check to see what the issues will be now that your hot-blown diffusers are going for Silverstone. What issues have you had for optimising what you have, and what risks are going to be for greater tyre degradation and issues like that?
This is quite a significant thing, because obviously midway through the season, what you've all been working with has now been changed quite a bit, and you've all got to adapt. So, I mean, how big an adaptation... I guess we've got to start with you, Paul. How big an adaptation process has it been?
Well, you're correct to say it's an interpretation of the regulations. You can't say it's a change. The first point of the technical directive that's come from the FIA is that it affects how we operate with the engine. So your first step in addressing this is to ensure that your engine complies with the latest interpretation of the rules, which is a reasonable chunk of work in itself. So assuming we accomplish that, you in parallel can look at the effect on your car. And all of the cars will be affected differently. I suppose the first thing that we will look at is, what's our loss of downforce? How does it affect the balance of the car around a lap? And we know where we're going next, so you can at least tailor your investigation to suit that particular circuit. You do your utmost to identify the deficiencies that it will give you, and concentrate your efforts on how you're going to get back what you've just lost. So I'm sure the gentlemen to my right are as busy as we are, and on Sunday afternoon we'll see who's been the most successful at achieving it. I don't think it will particularly change tyre degradation. I don't think it's going to be the magnitude of change that is perhaps being forecast in some areas. And as long as we're still on top, I don't mind.
Can you give us some sort of sense of context, James? Of, I mean, what is going to be, how much what are we talking about in terms of lap time, just generally across the field, not specifically your team, but give me an idea of how much of a difference this is going to make.
OK, we're all a bit coy with one another about the power of these devices, and it will vary from team to team. And I won't give you our number, but I'll give you a sense of it. If you imagine that these things might be worth, say, 0.8 of a second-ish, compared with having no blown diffuser, and you're broadly going down to about half of the previous authority of it. So by it's still got plenty of blowing going on because you've still got an engine running and that exhaust is still going right into your floor. But we're not able to optimise the use of the engine to make it also efficient as a pump when we're on partial throttle. That was the new interpretation that's being applied.
Just Paddy, looking at the wider picture, it's obviously not a desirable thing either for you or either for the fans to have to change things mid-season, because they've got a sense of having to kind of recalibrate their expectations, as do we in the media, and obviously you've got to recalibrate the cars. But so looking at the big picture, is it something that can be avoided in the future, do you think?
Well, for next year, the teams have all agreed a change in regulation on the geometry of the tailpipes so that they will go back towards the high-level exits that we had a year or two ago. So I think that's an example of where the teams can respond together constructively to do something for which they have a good notice period to react. They can all do a fair and proper job of it and not waste money. So I think generally the teams are finding this change mid-season to be not really the best way of solving the problem. I think also the problem is a little bit difficult to understand because teams have been blowing exhausts through diffusers for 20 years. So I know we probably all agree together that it's the timing has seemed a bit strange, but we have to react to it. Difficult thing to react to mid-season, but as Paul laid out, we're all doing the same things, and we'll see where we turn out in Silverstone.
It doesn't sound like Red Bull are going to be losing too much of an advantage from what Paul was saying. So let's have a change of gear then in terms of themes. And is Subain Uddin here? Subain Uddin? Yeah. Has a question about a bit of a flight of fancy, really, what you would give.
Hi. How fast could a Formula One car conceivably really go, and what would it look like if the rules allowed it?
So if you weren't restricted by the rules, what sort of stuff would you do? Paul?
I think my sort of technical boss, Mr. Newey, did a car for the Sony PlayStation game. I forget what it was called, and there was no rule book for that. He went and did what he thought was his ultimate car. So I would refer you to that. It did have a simulated lap time of Silverstone, I think, but off the top of my head, I wouldn't know what it was. A little bit quicker than we are now, I suspect.
Yeah. How about you, James? What would you do if you didn't have any restrictions on you?
Well, I actually don't think it would look much like Adrian's.
I
think that was... I don't know whether Adrian did draw that or whether it was a stylist's, dream. I think it would actually be an extraordinarily dull sport. You'd have little beetle-like things that would be fully skirted up to the floor with fans sucking all the air out from under them and sealing them to the ground. And drivers would go around every corner with their foot hard on the throttle and I think it'd be pretty boring. So I think we just need to be thankful that there are a decent set of rules that restrict us, which is not a popular view, but there you go.
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental problem with it, that you would create cars that would be perhaps even impossible to drive. I think you'd reach a point where the driver would be the limit. At the moment, to give an example, the G-forces that we generate in corners are around the 5G level. That's where they've been in the whole of the last 20 years. Even as we've developed more and more technology, but we've changed the rules to bring back the performance to a consistent level. If you left no limit, you'd end up with cars that could do such high G, for instance, that a driver would pass out. So at some point, you've got to put a limit. That's just a detailed example. Apart from anything else, the cars would be so fast. They'd be very dangerous. There'd be absolutely no overtaking because cars would be following such extreme trajectories. I think it wouldn't be the sport we'd want to see.
Okay, sounds fair enough. Is Ross Madden here? Ross Madden has a question, which I think will get you all thinking of it.
Hiya. With fuel being finite, are you looking at any point now what to do afterwards, whether it be hydrogen, electric-driven engines? So have you got a plan for when fuel does run out?
It's a good question. Thank you. James?
Well, I think Formula One will probably be one of the smaller problems to cope with when fuel runs out. But if you look at the 2014 engine, that is already moving in a direction that recognises the way the world is going. Fuel is becoming increasingly expensive. We will at some point or other get to the peak oil and then decline from there. And 2014 engine is all about recognizing those realities. It will be an engine where already an alternative energy source, or I guess it's harvested indirectly from the petrol, but we already will have electric energy in the car in quite large measure. With that engine. We already have it to a small degree now. I think when we get to the point where non-petrol cars are a part of our sport, I think that will be, you really need to look at what will be happening in road cars to determine that. I don't think there's too many analysts that expect hydrogen cars to be on the roads in the medium term, and although electric cars will increasingly have a role in city centres, fully electric cars, the technology with electric cars is not there yet to be able to put the sort of performance that we need on the road in pure electric mode. So I don't think it's coming in the next 5 years, and I think you need to look to the road cars to see the sort of horizon when it will come.
Is Martin Catlin around? Yes, Martin, you've got a question about multimedia being incorporated.
Yes, my question is about the different ways that we can view Formula One races with all the new multimedia online through iPads and that sort of thing, and showing practice and qualifying using those multimedia avenues. I mean, one of the good things that you can do here at McLaren is that they allow you to go on their website and you can see all the telemetry, the radio and things as it happens. And are there any plans for the other teams to follow suit?
Yeah, we touched on this earlier on. It's a very data-rich sport, Formula One. There's an awful lot you can offer. But Paul, what's your take on this one?
I don't know what we actually offer through our website because I've never followed it from that side of things. So I suppose really before answering the question, I ought to go and have a look. In terms of making it more accessible, as the team principals alluded to earlier, then we've got to be prepared to open up. There are probably some commercial difficulties. There's a little bit of exclusivity in there that we may have to deal with. But in terms of making more available, personally, think it would be good for the sport to do so.
But what about the whole issue of secrecy? I mean, you've obviously got, you've got five or eight blokes standing around the back of your car on the grid, making sure that nosy parkers like me can't see exactly what you've got going on. But
I don't think that's unreasonable. I would hope you're applauding the five blokes that stand at the back of each car and do a phenomenal job of keeping the prying eyes away. Equally, Paddy, I'm sure, would love to have a look at the back of our car. James, occasion might be found somewhere near the back of our car, as we might be found near the back of his. So it's a part of the sport that goes on. You remember, we're in competition with one another, and we build prototype cars. And every time we go to a Grand Prix, that's our best statement of our technology and our knowledge at the time. Now, if we see something on James's car that we quite like, we are not sort of too proud to not copy it. And equally, I'd say there are features he's seen on ours he might like. He chooses to use it, it's entirely his business. And I think that aspect of it is one we have to keep, because we are a constructor championship. We race one another. I hope, as a show, that it's entertaining. If all the cars were very open and you could see everything, then we almost lose the constructor title, to my mind. So a little bit of competitiveness and therefore a little bit of secrecy is hand in hand with our sport.
What's the trade-off point, Paddy, between keeping the secrets that you have to keep and opening things up to the fans?
I think it's very like the discussion we had about radios, and the equivalent exists for seeing cars. There are rules that stop us now from placing covers around the car or around the garage. You may remember a few years ago, I can't remember how far back it was, James, you might recall, but it had reached the point where the teams were completely shrouding their cars, big screens in front of the garage whenever the car was in there, and Bernie came out one day and said, it's all stopping, and there now is a rule that prevents that, so we can't actually use covers. It means it's the same for everybody, and I think that's good, because the winners are the fans, because they get to see the cars, which is, after all, what they switched on to see. So I think it's a great shame if we don't stand together with openness on that. Although it's sort of, in some ways, amusing what Paul's guys do at the back of the car, the reality is that James and I know exactly what's going on behind that, because we have photographs from other occasions. We all do this. I quite enjoy sending the odd photo to Paul after a race of his floor. So,
pointing out the mistakes.
Yeah, with a few suggestions, yeah. So I actually think that the loser there is you guys, because we, through the benefit of the rule preventing covers in general, we get to see what we want to see.
How many of you, just out of interest, would like to know more from a technological point of view? I mean, how many of you wish there was less? Yeah, interesting. So you'd all say that you're pretty interested in, you guys feel that technology is important and that information is important.
I think what's fantastic about the fan base of Formula One is that they are generally a very technical audience. I think that sets you apart from the sort of football fan, let's say.
I knew you were going to say that.
You understand and you want to understand technology, and I think that's great, and we need to make sure we keep feeding that.
I honestly don't think it's a massive issue of secrecy, because there is so much that all the teams do where we're all doing more or less the same thing, and yet it's sort of hidden from view, but, well, to my mind at least, quite interesting. And all of us could talk, until you probably lost the will to live, about the technical detail of the sport without betraying any particular secret of our particular team, because we would just be revealing to you things that go on in the sport that are interesting, that we're all doing, but are currently hidden. So there's all manner of things technical that we can talk about without any conflicts of secrecy whatsoever that I think is of moderate interest.
Okay, thank you for that. Is Laura Pritchard here? Laura Pritchard, is she here? There we go.
Okay, it makes sense. There's questions in this panel. I think I'm brave enough to say in this audience that women are renowned for being great problem-solving multitaskers. So I'm interested in more women in F1, and in particular seeing them in engineering, because I still see that as being an area where there aren't that many, and I wondered what your thoughts were in that area.
Paul, you've got several female engineers, haven't you? I've seen, I'm sure.
I dare say all the teams represented here, all the teams in F1 probably have. To answer your question, we receive applications and we'll react to the applications. I think, as Ross alluded to, there are a number of graduates in our company. I'm not sure they're as cheap as Ross might paint the picture for. We have a number of undergraduates completing their industrial year with us, and a number of those are seemingly very bright young people and very bright young ladies in that group as well. One of our best FE engineers is a very talented lady.
FE?
Finite element, one of our structures. And so I don't think there's a prejudice. It's more a case of if you apply, if you stand as good a chance as anybody. So I don't think there's prejudice. Please apply.
It's interesting.
We want the best people, not necessarily the best gender.
Ross was talking about the F1 in schools program. There are a lot of girls who take part in that at school level. And one of the problems is they seem to drop out when they get more towards university level. Is that because it's not seen as a subject women want to study at engineering at university level? What's your view, Paddy?
I don't know the answer to that, James. But what I do know is that we're seeing more coming through, I'd say. We try and encourage it when we can. Because I think it's something that we think should be pushed. So I fully support, you know, the reasoning behind your question. And we are seeing more applications and many more successful applications. So, you know, we have more women in our engineering team than we've had in the past.
Quick response on that, James?
I certainly feel no duty to employ women over men in any way. I get mildly annoyed by the stereotypes of, you know, women are good multitasking decision makers and men are good at parking, although obviously that bit's true. But we like, I'm sure the other two, we react to the quality of the applicant. And what is fantastic is that as the years have gone on and Formula One has become more and more of an impressive organisation, the quality of applicants that we get, both men and women, is always increasing. Some of the people that apply to us now, the quality of their intellect and what they bring to us is breathtaking. And I can echo what Paddy says. We see more and more women applying to us now, and more women with real quality. And as a consequence, we are seeing more and more women employed in our company at the technical level. And and I wouldn't welcome them because they're women, but I would certainly welcome them because they bring a lot to the party.
Final comment on this?
Just echoing very much what James said, I think in general, something I find very, very encouraging is that, you know, the media is full of the problems of the youth today. I'd have to say that the youth we see coming through are much more disciplined and hardworking than I seem to remember that we were at that stage. So I find that immensely encouraging.
That's a great point. You've got a comment you'd like to make on that? Gentleman at the back?
Well, from what I understand, talking to some engineers, the problem isn't actually women applying to Formula One. It's getting women into engineering as a start. And more when they get to university, it's seen as a bit of a lad's course and a lad's experience. Is there anything that Formula One teams and engineering people in general can do to combat that, do you think?
I think that's a bit of what the F1 in schools thing is trying to do on Formula students, isn't it? As much as anything else.
Yeah, and I guess even just making Formula One more appealing to everybody from a young age must be something to encourage that, because Formula One is a sport that's about engineering as well as great drivers. So I think it's a route through which we can communicate engineering and technical interest to a very, very large part of the globe. And I think that's a great story for engineering itself. You know, the media are not always that brilliant at portraying the interest in technology that is actually out there.
Okay, then let's move on. Lindsay McLeod, are you here? Lindsay McLeod has a question for us. It's a great question, actually, about teammates.
You're, both your teammates get the exact same equipment, and you see such a disparity, say, with Vettel and Webber at the moment, that it just seems there's such a gap. So I was wondering, they have the same equipment. What is the difference in the drivers that you see that gives them such a disparity?
That's a very, very good question. Let's not single out Vettel and Webber necessarily. It happens throughout the field, doesn't it? But Paul, in general, I mean, you've worked in Formula One a long time. You've seen lots of teammate pairings. How would you answer that question of Lindsay's?
I personally think there are two aspects to it. One is their confidence levels, and the other one is how well they handle almost what happens in that last part of qualifying. The confidence levels, you can see them go rise and fall between teammates through a season. We saw that very much within our team last year. As and when you sort of get into that last part of qualifying, which is where I suspect your question is referring to, if you had access to the data, then you might see that one driver will make a small mistake at one corner and then pays a penalty all the way down the subsequent straight, potentially even series of corners. And it produces a lap time difference, shall we argue, of 2/10. All of a sudden, that's 3 places on the grid. And you say, oh, well, Sebastian's sitting on pole and Mark's 4th, or Mark's on pole and Seb's 5th. What on earth happened there? It's one small mistake on that qualifying lap in Q3, and that's produced that whole difference. And so I think when we sort of look at these seemingly large gaps, they're actually minute gaps. The consequence of such a competitive sport is that that small mistake costs you quite a lot. And each of the cars are separated by 8 metres on the track, and all of a sudden you're 24, 32 metres behind your teammate, wondering what on earth happened. But the gaps are surprisingly small. So I wouldn't suggest that any of the drivers are underperforming. And in our case, I'm sure Mark will sort Sebastian out at some point during this year. He probably can't wait to do it at Silverstone, and we'll see what happens.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because fans obviously talk amongst themselves, oh, he's a load of rubbish and he's fantastic, whatever it may be. But you guys actually have all the devices for measuring just how fantastic the Grand Prix drivers are. James, I mean, how accurately do you know year after year with the drivers that come through just how terrific they are and the gaps, the real gap between their performances, the teammates?
I think it's very difficult to make comparisons across seasons. And it's very easy to think that a driver is a constant, and he's not. As Paul was saying, his ability waxes and wanes with his confidence, and it can be once he feels he's going well, then things will go well for him because his confidence is up. We can tell you fairly accurately at any given point how much quicker one guy is than the other guy because they have got equal kit. And the qualifying is a reasonable way of ranking them in order of competence on the day. But I think one of the things that makes the sport so interesting is the dynamic between the teammates. You know, it would be a much more, much less interesting sport if every team only entered one driver. That would be one great big area of wrangling that completely disappeared from the sport. And for all that some drivers get on better with other drivers than maybe, you know, some of the relationships get quite fraught, and some of them are more friendly. If you go and watch that Senna film that's out, I think one of the most interesting parts of that film is the whole relationship that Senna had with Prost, and that is a layer of richness in the sport that's utterly fascinating to me.
Paddy?
I absolutely agree with James. I think having that ability for two drivers to compete with the same equipment is a very important part of the interest to the spectators. It's said, and it's really quite true, that the most important thing from a driver's point of view is to not be beaten by your teammate because he's in the same equipment. And I often also hear it said that, you know, are you giving the same equipment to this driver or that I think my colleagues would agree with me. We go to a lot of effort to build the best car we can on the day. You know, that is what we're all about. It takes an immense amount of work, an immense amount of money to do that. And the idea that we would kind of hold something back from one of the cars so that it wasn't as quick as we knew how to make it is really absurd. So there are very, very rare exceptions to that. You know, if you produce some magic widget that you can only make one of for that weekend. I've only known that happen once at McLaren in the last 5 years, so that's very rare. So the equipment's the same. I think it's fantastically interesting that the drivers can then compete against each other as well as then against the other teams. And it allows you to discriminate between the car and the driver as well.
Okay, perfect. Right, James Van Brecht, are you here? James Van Brecht has a question I'm sure many of you are wondering about as well.
Hi. In the context that I'm not a fan of the current jelly-style tyres we have, I'd rather see a reintroduction of refuelling. How would you feel about refuelling?
What would you think about bringing back refuelling? Is there any chance of that happening? Who, James?
I think it would be the wrong thing to do personally, but I think there's no right or wrong answer to that. I'll give you my reasons why I think it'd be better to stick with what we've got. Having a race with no refueling means that you tend to do your racing on the track, not via pit stop strategy. The refueling makes the pit stops slow and much less of a spectacle than the current pit stops are, which I think are quite interesting in the sort of frantic explosion of activity that happens. And from a team point of view, it costs quite a lot of money to shunt the refueling kit all around the world and have the people look after it. And also, it's stuff that we don't own. It's, well, we own it, we have to buy it, but we can't design it. And when it goes wrong, no matter how much love and care and attention you festoon upon it, occasionally it did go wrong. It's an extraordinarily bitter feeling. To see your opportunities in the race squandered by something that you don't actually have direct control over. So from my personal perspective, I think that the rules without refueling are preferable.
One more point of view on this, maybe, Paul, you got a view?
So my personal preference, I would agree with James, in that I wouldn't rush to bring it back. I don't think the sport has suffered in removing refueling. The pit stops are an amazing spectacle. We're very privileged and we stand very close to them. And as James described, it is an utter explosion. And you hear all four wheel guns go together if you're on a good pit stop, and you hear all four go again, and the car's gone. And we're back in the race. If we consider Formula One to be a show, the show hasn't suffered. We now have a little bit of a change of emphasis for the drivers, in that they've got to now take a car from qualifying where it had a minimum amount of fuel into something with a fairly significant amount of fuel into the race. So they've got to make that transition. It presents them with a different challenge. And does it open up the first part of the race? Well, there's a few of them here after us, and I think you can probably ask those that question. So personally, I wouldn't bring it back. The show hasn't suffered. It's still a good sport and it still seems to be entertaining. Don't know who's always going to be in what order in the end of the race.
Well, that's a perfect moment to stop and to say thank you very much to these three gentlemen, Paddy Lowe, James Allison and Paul Manahan, the engineers.
Thanks for listening to part two of the Photo Fans Forum podcast, brought to you by Autosport and USP Content. Don't forget to tune in to the third and final part.